They said it was just a missing girl, a misunderstanding, a glitch in the paperwork. But I saw the basement. I heard the recordings. I was supposed to teach music. Instead, I uncovered a machine powered by children, silence, and stolen lives. They erased the emails, the money trails, even me. Now I live with a new name, and the one rule that kept me breathing. Trust no one. This isn't just a true crime story. It's a confession. And if you're hearing this, it means they haven't buried everything. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The first note always sounds harmless. There's a strange kind of silence in a piano studio just before it opens. It's not peaceful, it's loaded. Like the air is waiting for something to go wrong. That was my life most days. Mornings started with coffee that never got finished, half-tuned Steinways, and a schedule full of kids whose parents wanted to turn them into prodigies. That Thursday started no different. Rain slid down the glass windows like it was trying to wash the building away. I didn't know yet that by the end of the week, everything I believed in, truth, justice, people, would be burned to the fucking ground. Her name was Lila Carver. 9 years old, brilliant ears, tiny hands, played like the piano owed her something. She was my favorite student, and I never said that about anyone. She had this way of pausing before each piece, like she was waiting for the music to get permission to be heard. And then there was him, her father, Elliot Carver. He came in with umbrellas no one touched and shoes that didn't know what dirt felt like. He didn't speak much, just nodded, smiled a little too wide, and always watched me from the glass partition like he was studying something more than music. That day, he approached me for the first time. "Mr. Ellis," he said, with a voice like polished mahogany, "have you ever considered expanding your talents?" I should have said no. Should have smiled politely and gone back to the Chopin etude Lila was working on. But that voice, it was persuasive in a way that didn't ask for trust. It demanded it. He talked about a foundation, a nonprofit, dedicated to nurturing artistic youth in underprivileged areas. He wanted a music consultant. Said I'd be perfect. The money was generous. So generous it felt like charity in reverse. My gut said it was too good to be real. But my bank account begged me to say yes. I said I'd think about it. By the end of the day, a contract showed up in my inbox. No red flags, just red stamps, official legal looking perfect. Perfection in detailing. Over the next week, I was brought into Carver's world slowly, like a frog in warm water. A tour of his downtown building. The studio we'd build. Donor lists. Board meetings. All staged with clean suits and tighter smiles. It felt curated, carefully curated, in fact, but I wasn't looking for flaws yet. I was too busy imagining what it could mean for my career. For the first time, I wasn't just a teacher. I was being trusted as a partner. That word, trust, kept echoing in my mind like a broken metronome. Tick. Trust. Tock. No one tells you it's the first step toward manipulation. The first real warning came not from Carver, but from his daughter. After one lesson, Lila sat at the edge of the bench and whispered, "Daddy says you know how to keep secrets." Her voice didn't carry any joy. Just a strange weight, too heavy for her age. I asked her what she meant, and she changed the subject, just like that. Smiled and asked to learn something sad. I taught her Eric Satie. I didn't sleep that night. Within 2 weeks, I was officially director of artistic strategy. Whatever the hell that meant. My name was printed on foundation documents, donor events, business cards. I was at meetings with people who never said what they did, only what they believed in. That's when I noticed something. The numbers didn't match. A concert fundraiser raised $80,000. The charity reported $10,000. A check I signed never reached its destination. Every time I brought it up, someone brushed me off with talk about red tape or bureaucratic delay. But it didn't feel like delay. It felt like erasure. Like I was slowly being erased from my own choices. One night, I stayed late in the studio, trying to reconcile financial records. That's when I saw it, an offshore account number, tucked away in a payment file labeled Culture Grant Transfer. It wasn't subtle. It was confident. And that scared me more than anything. You don't hide things that well unless you know no one's looking. Unless you've done it before. When I confronted Carver the next morning, he didn't flinch. Just smiled, that same too perfect grin, and said, "You're not paid to ask questions, Mr. Ellis. You're paid to make music." He clapped my shoulder gently. "Trust me, this is how foundations survive." The touch felt like a threat, or maybe I was finally feeling what had always been there. That night, I got a message in my mailbox. No return address. No handwriting. Just a printout. A single sentence. Screams don't echo in rooms built to silence. And I swear to you, I heard a piano key press itself in the dark. One note. Low. Cold. Wrong. That was the first time I thought, maybe this isn't just a financial scam. Maybe this is a goddamn crime scene. But I wasn't ready for how far the shadows would stretch. I wasn't ready for the screams from the basement. And I sure as hell wasn't ready for what they'd do to shut me up. Where money sleeps, secrets breathe. There's something about money that changes the way people look at you. Not just when you have it, but when they think you know where it sleeps. I didn't realize it at the time, but stepping into Carver's world meant stepping into a crime scene so clean, it looked like luxury. The real evidence, it was hidden in the margins. In spreadsheets with no decimal points. In cultural initiatives that didn't exist. In kids who vanished from the program roster and never returned. I thought I was part of a music movement. Turns out, I was part of a goddamn laundering cycle, with blood under the piano keys. The deeper I went, the more things started to smell like fraud. Fake names on donor lists. Grants awarded to nonprofits that didn't have physical addresses. Offshore accounts being funneled through shell organizations. I started tracking where the money went after fundraisers. Most of it never made it to the underprivileged communities we were supposed to serve. Some ended up in the Caymans. Some in Switzerland. One transaction showed up in Belize under a fishing company with no boats. This wasn't just mishandling. This was orchestrated. Deliberate. This was financial crime theater, choreographed down to the last zero. And I was on stage without knowing the script. I tried talking to the board. That's when I realized how deep the rot went. They smiled. Nodded. Promised to investigate. Then they froze my access. Emails returned undelivered. Passwords changed. My studio keycard no longer worked. It was like they were peeling me off the narrative, rewriting it without me. Justice tales, they called them in the newsletters. But I knew, those tales were fiction dressed in tax write-offs. And every time I got closer to truth, I felt a hand tugging at the back of my neck like I was being pulled underwater. Then came the phone call. No caller ID. No greeting. Just a voice that sounded like it had gravel in its throat. Ask another question, and you'll find yourself listed as a donor, in memoriam. Click. I thought it was a joke. Until I saw the body. 2 days later, just past dusk, I was driving past Carver's estate, a place I usually avoided. But something in me needed to see it. Needed to feel like I had some kind of edge again. I slowed down near the northern fence line when I saw two things. A flicker of movement in the woods, and a blue scarf snagged on the barbed wire. I recognized it. One of the student volunteers, Maria. She hadn't shown up for the last 3 sessions. I'd texted. No reply. Something in my chest broke loose. I parked the car, climbed the fence, and followed the scarf into the woods. What I found changed everything. It wasn't just Maria. It was evidence. Her phone. Her ID badge. Torn sheet music soaked in mud. And then, further in, a makeshift concrete slab. Unmarked. Fresh. Still warm under my hand. Bureaucracy buried her. That's what I kept thinking. That and, how many others? I backed out of the forest, heart thundering. That night, I tried to file a report. The police officer looked bored. Told me Maria probably ran off. Young people do that, he said. No crime unless you find a body. I said I found signs. He called it speculation. Told me there was red tape, processes, and a backlog of cases. Said I'd be better off waiting. Waiting. For what? Another fucking burial. I went home, locked every door, and opened my laptop. This time, I wasn't going to just look at numbers. I was going to unravel this entire thing. That's when I noticed it, a name I didn't expect. Mine. My signature was on a document that funneled $120,000 into something called Nature's Secrets. A conservation charity. Except, I'd never signed that. And I sure as hell never worked with conservation groups. The signature was perfect. Too perfect. I knew then, they weren't just laundering money. They were laundering identities. Using mine. And just like that, I went from whistleblower to suspect. From observer to scapegoat. Now they were painting me into the story. One where the good teacher stole from kids, disappeared a girl, and vanished into thin air. That's what you get when you challenge the ones who control the investigation narratives. I wasn't paranoid anymore. I was hunted. And if I didn't move fast, I'd end up buried next to Maria. Another secret in the soil. Screams don't leave a trace. The next morning, I woke up drenched in sweat, half expecting to find cops at my door. But there was only silence, and a letter slid under my apartment door. No stamp, no sender, just a folded envelope that reeked of cologne and control. Inside, a photo of Maria standing in the hallway of the New Music Center, smiling, alive, dated 2 days after the last time I saw her. But I knew better. That wasn't proof of life. It was a message. We control the timeline. That photo was followed by a knock on the door later that afternoon. Two plainclothes officers, smiling, polite, said they were following up on a tip regarding charitable misappropriation and inappropriate contact with minors. That last part made my throat close. I felt like the floor vanished under my feet. I wasn't just being erased. I was being rewritten as the villain. They didn't arrest me, yet, but they confiscated my laptop, my phone, my hard drives. I asked for a warrant. They said it was on the way. That's when I understood. This wasn't an investigation. It was an elimination. A slow bleed under the guise of procedure. Red tape as a weapon, bureaucracy as a scalpel. I stood in my own apartment as they walked out with the only proof I had, and all I could do was breathe through the nausea. With everything stripped from me, I had two choices: disappear or expose them before they could bury me. I chose both. I went underground, switched SIM cards, slept in motels, used cash only. I began documenting everything I remembered. Every dollar discrepancy. Every fake grant. Every moment Lila said something she wasn't supposed to know. The shadows of justice didn't just live in the courtroom. They thrived in nonprofit filings, hidden in the footnotes of tax reports, buried under names like Nature's Secrets and Southern Youth Revival. The deeper I dug, the more I realized. This was an empire built on goodwill and financial crime. But there was one location I'd avoided since the beginning, the New Music Center. The building I helped design, funded through those very cultural grants, now twisted around my neck. My name was on the plaque at the entrance, etched in metal like a mockery. I decided to break in. It was after midnight when I slipped in through the side door. The alarm system was a joke, installed for optics, not security. The air was stale inside, too quiet for a building designed for music. I moved room to room, past pianos that had never been touched, classrooms with untouched books. It was all a fucking stage set. Then I saw the elevator. It wasn't in the original floor plan. I forced it open using a crowbar I'd stashed in my backpack. Behind it, a service shaft with a narrow stairwell leading downward. I counted 25 steps. At the bottom was a steel door. No handle, just a keypad. I tried dates, combinations. Nothing worked. But then I remembered Lila's hands. How she always played Moonlight Sonata in D minor, even when I asked her not to. D minor. D-M-I-N-O-R. I tried it. The keypad blinked. The door unlocked. And what I saw inside will never leave me. A narrow basement with soundproof walls. No furniture. No windows. Just a lone piano bench. And dozens, dozens of student photos pinned to the wall like trophies. Their eyes scratched out. In the corner, a crate. Inside it, hard drives. Dozens. And a folder labeled Voice Lessons Confidential. I opened it. The first file was Maria. Audio. Crying. Begging. Then static. I dropped the file, hands shaking. I'd found it. The heart of the machine. The truth buried under fake melodies and financial scams. This wasn't just corruption. This was a crime farm, grooming kids under the guise of charity, using financial shielding to keep anyone from tracing it. And I'd helped build the goddamn stage. I took what I could, photos, files, one of the drives, and got out. My phone buzzed as I crossed the street. Unknown number. A voice I didn't recognize. We warned you, Mr. Ellis. Now you're part of the show. Click. I didn't go home that night. I didn't sleep for the next 3 days. The piano studio that once made me feel alive now played in my memory like a morgue. And every time I closed my eyes, I heard it again. A single key. Played from the basement. And I realized some screams are composed. Played note by note. Until they vanish. The spotlight burns the innocent. The media storm came fast. Within 48 hours of my break-in, every local news outlet had my face splashed across screens like a fugitive composer. Headlines screamed with accusations. Piano teacher launders millions, charity funds missing in shocking scheme, hidden killers behind the keys. They even used a photo of me holding Lila's hand after her first recital. Twisted it. Cropped it. Made it look like something it wasn't. That's the thing about the true crime genre. People don't care if it's true. They just want the crime. And Carver had weaponized that thirst. I tried to go to the police again, armed with files, screenshots, even one of the hard drives. But the moment I walked in, I was told to wait. Three officers stared from behind a glass wall. Then a detective came out, stone-faced, and asked if I was aware there was a warrant for my arrest. Fraud. Embezzlement. Obstruction. They said I'd vanished with key documents. That I was tampering with ongoing investigations. I left before they could cuff me. I knew I had minutes, maybe less. I didn't even make it back to my car. I ran, hid in the alley, then kept running. By the time the sun came up, I was on the move again. No ID, no phone, just a flash drive taped to my leg and the paranoia that everyone on the street was reading the same article about me. My old students stopped responding to messages. Friends ghosted me. I became the story. One of those unsettling narratives that people whisper about but never question. Because truth doesn't trend. Chilling accounts, though. Those go viral. I needed a voice louder than mine. Someone who knew the language of crime scene investigations and financial smoke screens. That's when I remembered her, Riley Quinn, a freelance journalist I met once at a fundraiser. She was sharp, blunt, and hated bureaucracy with a passion. Her podcast, Unveiled, was known for dissecting justice tales that got buried under red tape. I reached out through a burner account, sent her a single message. They're using kids to wash money. I have proof. I need a storyteller, not a savior. She responded in 12 minutes. We met at a diner outside the city limits. She wore a gray hoodie and kept one hand on her recorder the entire time. I told her everything, from the first offer to the basement discovery. She didn't blink, just took notes. When I finished, she asked one question. Do you have anything that isn't digital? I handed her a stack of printed bank records and screenshots. Her expression changed. This isn't just charity fraud, she said. This is strategic financial corruption. These aren't just grants. They're smoke bombs. Every missing dollar is probably propping up some senator's vacation home or corporate lobbyist with a clean conscience. She agreed to help. To dig, publish, expose. But she warned me. If this goes wide, you won't just be hunted. You'll be erased. Legally. Financially. Maybe even literally. Two nights later, she sent me a file she decrypted from the drive I gave her. One name stood out, the Carver Trust. A so-called legacy fund stretching back decades, supposedly dedicated to youth education and artistic development. But the transactions told a different story. Payments routed through offshore accounts, disguised as consulting fees and cultural grants. Riley called it wealth shielding disguised as virtue. That same night, her apartment was broken into. Nothing stolen, just her desk trashed. Her recorder smashed. Her notes gone, except she kept backups, hidden like she expected this. She told me to run. Again, this time to an old farmhouse she used for deep work. No cell signal, no internet. Just a roof and a door that locked. I stayed there for 3 days, and then the letter came. No stamp. Again, just a clean white envelope slid under the door. Inside, a single photo. Lila, sitting at a piano, eyes hollow, and on the back. If you love stories so much, Mr. Ellis, let's give them a finale. Below that, a date, a time, and a GPS coordinate. It pointed to the foundation's new building, where it all began. They weren't threatening me anymore. They were inviting me. The stage was set. The keys that played the truth. I arrived just after midnight. Fog hung thick over the lot like nature knew what was buried inside. The foundation building loomed ahead, sterile, beautiful, and hollow. A mausoleum for manipulated dreams. The GPS coordinates led me to the side entrance again, the same one I used weeks ago. It was unlocked this time. No resistance. No alarm. Just that same dead silence that hums right before violence. The halls were darker now. The posters of smiling children curled at the edges. The grand piano in the main room was closed and covered in dust. I moved quietly, every step echoing in my ribs like a warning. Then I saw it, a light on in the basement. That unmarked, soundproof underworld. The one not listed in the building plans. And for the first time, I didn't hesitate. I took the stairs two at a time, heart pounding against my ribs like a war drum. When I reached the steel door, it was already cracked open. Inside was a small crowd, three men in tailored suits, one woman with a clipboard, and in the center, sitting on the same piano bench I'd seen in my nightmares, was Lila. She looked smaller, paler, a child drained of light. Her hands trembled as she pressed the keys, soft, slow, mechanical. She didn't see me at first. Her eyes were distant, vacant. One of the men turned toward me, smiling with teeth too white. "Mr. Ellis," he said, "you're right on time." He gestured to a wall of monitors behind him. Each screen displayed different recordings, lessons, interviews, even therapy sessions, all harvested from years of sessions at the piano studio. Dozens of children, their faces pixelated, their names replaced with file codes. "We call this," he said, "the Echo Archive. It's how we keep our investments compliant." "Investments?" I asked. "Children," he said. "Their data, their behavior, their voice patterns. It's all value, metadata for predictive marketing, security, even intelligence training. We train AIs on their reactions, their responses to music, fear, suggestion." He stepped closer. "You helped us perfect it." I wanted to vomit. They weren't just hiding money. They were harvesting human emotion and selling it to the highest bidder. Financial crimes layered over technological exploitation. This was beyond laundering. This was a factory of influence, a place where children became algorithms and memories became capital. I reached for Lila. One of the men stepped in. I punched him hard. He went down with a sickening crack. The woman screamed. I grabbed Lila by the arm and ran, dragging her through the stairwell as alarms finally blared to life. Somewhere behind us, a man shouted, "Secure the archive." But I didn't stop. Not this time. We burst out into the alley. I threw her into the passenger seat of the rusted-out pickup Riley helped me borrow. Tires squealed. Headlights flooded the rearview mirror. We disappeared into the fog. 2 hours later, we were hidden at a safe house, one of Riley's backups. Lila didn't speak for a long time, just stared out the window. Then softly, she asked, "Do they know where we are?" I didn't lie. Maybe, but not yet. That night, I transferred every file I stole, every piece of the chilling narrative, to Riley. She released a limited drop, voice clips, financial trails, images of the hidden rooms. She titled the episode, "The Keys They Never Heard." It went viral, but so did the retaliation. Within 24 hours, the Carver Foundation website vanished. Articles about me spiked, then disappeared. Riley's apartment burned down 2 days later. Arson. No suspects. I realized something then. The shadows of justice don't fear exposure. They fear endurance. Stories fade. Files get lost. But the voices? If you protect those, they echo. They haunt. So I made one last decision. I took Lila and went off-grid. Changed names. Erased us. Let the world forget us so she could remember who she was. But before I disappeared completely, I sent one final message to every journalist, every forum, every true crime fan who had ever claimed to care about the truth. Don't look for me. Don't chase a name. Chase the silence. That's where the crimes live. Because in the end, the scariest part wasn't what they did in the dark. It was how well they lit the stage. Some truths stay buried for survival. It's been 9 months since I vanished. 9 months since I stopped being Mr. Ellis, the man who taught children how to feel through music and became a shadow dodging shadows. Lila is safe, or at least safer than she was. Her laughter comes in fragments now. Soft, careful, like she's relearning what it means to be real. I changed our names, changed everything. I even stopped playing piano. Not because I lost love for it, but because every note reminds me of what was stolen. The news cycle moved on, like it always does. Riley's final podcast upload still circulates quietly among true crime forums and whistleblower communities. An episode people claim is too intense to be real, labeled a sinister case, a true story disguised as fiction. They debate whether I existed, whether Riley was a myth, whether Lila was code for something else. But those who listen closely, those who still believe in chilling narratives, they know. They hear it in the background. A single piano note, recorded in a concrete basement, never resolved. That's the echo I left behind. That's the evidence that can't be buried. 2 weeks ago, I received a burner voicemail. No number. Just a message. They've rebranded. New front. New children. Same board. Carver's dead, but the system survives. It always does. They're calling it the Meridian Initiative now. "You still listening, Ellis?" Then a pause. Then Riley's voice. If you're hearing this, I didn't make it, but the story will, because we weren't chasing justice. We were unraveling secrets, and secrets don't die. They multiply. I sat with that message for hours, played it over and over until the tape warped. She knew. She always knew this wasn't a war we'd win. This was a crime story about survival, about escaping a system so meticulously built, it wears perfection in detailing like armor. The files we exposed forced a few resignations, a few audits, but no trials, no convictions. Just reshuffling, bureaucracy's favorite illusion of justice. The shadows of justice aren't just people, they're policies, systems, tax codes, executives who can sleep through screams as long as the money hums steady in offshore accounts. I tell myself we did something. That Lila sleeps easier. That Riley's voice will outlive the fire. That our investigative storytelling stirred someone somewhere to dig deeper. Maybe that's enough. But I'll never trust again. Not the courts. Not the headlines. Not even the allies who stood beside me. Because when you stare into the abyss of financial crimes, what stares back isn't just greed. It's a mirror. One that shows you the price of asking questions. The price of remembering too much. So if you're listening to this, if you made it through every gripping tale, every murder narrative buried under charity buzzwords and tax-deductible lies, know this. The crime that convinced me to trust no one wasn't just the one they committed. It was the one they convinced the world never happened. And maybe, just maybe, that's the perfect crime.